The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 234.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my very good friend, FinTwit Rockstar. Brent Johnson himself is here to give us an update on all his macro views. Brent, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thanks for having me, George. It's great to be here. Always enjoy talking to you.
Yeah. So I think I saw a tweet of yours the other day, how you're talking about maybe ag prices going up. Can you kind of tell us where we are on the dollar milkshake theory? Kind of give us an update, what your views are there on the dollar. That's what most people are going to want to know right off the bat. But then kind of tell us about the nuance and the detail of that view when it comes to agriculture and maybe some other things you've been thinking through.
Sure. So you want me to start with agriculture or you want me to start with the dollar? Where do you want me to start?
Try the dollar.
Okay. So, you know, I think I was on here almost exactly a year ago, George. I know we've spoken a few times since then, but I remember being here a year ago and it was kind of we were just kind of coming out of the March crisis. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how I was expecting a big bounce out of March, out of the March low, which we got. We got into June and I thought that we would have a retest. Maybe we wouldn't go all the way back down to the March lows, but I thought we would have a retest. So we thought the dollar would come off. We thought, you know, risk assets would rally, but then we thought we'd come back and have some kind of a retest. Well, we never got the retest. So, you know, markets have just kind of continued to grind higher. And, you know, what we always thought with the dollar, the reason we thought that the dollar would go higher and why we still think it would go higher is, you know, this, we started thinking this long before we ever knew about the pandemic, right? We just knew the table was set for a rapidly appreciating dollar. We didn't know what the catalyst would be. And we thought that it would play out over, let's call it 3 to 4 years. So, you know, we kind of thought 2023 to 2024 would be the latest it would play out. It could play out anytime up to there, but it could take 3 or 4 years. And we thought it would be a series of, you know, the dollar would run, it would pull back, it would run again, it would pull back. And then when COVID hit, we incorrectly thought that COVID would accelerate everything and it would compress the time in which this happened. But that was wrong. And actually, having seen what's happened since then, it actually has deferred it. And I think it could actually push it out even farther than I initially thought, where I was originally thinking, you know, 2023, maybe 2024. I'm now thinking 2024, maybe 2025.
And Brent, when you say it for the viewers who might not understand or have heard of the dollar milkshake theory, this is when the dollar is going up to maybe 120, 130 on the DXY.
That's right. So the dollar milkshake theory is really an event-driven thesis. And we have not entered the thesis. A lot of people ask me, you know, how's the dollar milkshake theory doing? And I said, we haven't even gotten to it yet. The thesis is how I believe markets will react and things will play out once we enter a currency crisis and a sovereign debt crisis. Now, it has taken a lot longer to get there than I thought it would. I thought that we would enter that sovereign debt crisis, currency crisis in, you know, 2020, 2021, and we still could.
Yeah. Right? And to be clear, when you're talking about a sovereign debt crisis and currency crisis, you're not talking about the dollar. You're talking about emerging
globally, right. And it's not that the dollar won't be affected, and it's not that the U.S. won't have a crisis of its own. It's just that I believe that the rest of the world will have more trouble dealing with it initially than the U.S., right?
Right.
And so that has been deferred. It's funny when you talk macro, everything kind of relates to each other, and it's hard to tell a story with macro, because to tell a story, you kind of have to talk about, you know, in a linear fashion, right? But everything's kind of interconnected, and, you know, things aren't going to, I'm not going to get it, you know, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, chapter four. I'm not going to get it right in succession. There's just no way. I've got an ego, but my ego isn't that big, right? you know, and so, But to tell a story, you kind of have to tell it linearly to get people to understand it. But, you know, chapter four could become chapter two, right? And chapter three could end up being chapter seven. But essentially what we think will happen is because of all the debts in the world and because the anemic growth in the world, and we can talk about that a little bit, we don't think that the global economy is growing at a sufficient rate to service all the global debt. The dollar denominated debt. Well, not just the dollar denominated, all the debt in the world, but mm-hmm. primarily the dollar denominated debt. And because the dollar is the world reserve currency, and because many people owe in the dollar, that's actually demand for dollars. And so we believe that that will come back. Now, I give the central banks and the monetary authorities, you know, all the credit in the world that they have been able. We thought that they would be able to defer it a little bit last year. We didn't think they'd be able to defer it for a year. And, you know, maybe they can defer it for another year. You know, I don't know for sure. But I don't think they've solved anything. I think what they have succeeded in doing is pushing it down the road. But what that did, I'm going to bring this back to commodities a little bit, is you've probably heard me say several times that I'm not on board with this global reflation theory thesis, right? Now, I'm not going to sit here and say we haven't had inflationary pressures. You know, I get these messages and emails and DMs that says, how can you not see that inflation is here? Prices are going up. And like, of course, you know, all you have to do is look at your screen to know that prices are going up and the dollar has come down. That's not the question. The question is whether it is sustainable or not. And right. I don't think that this global reflation thesis is sustainable until and unless we get a handoff from the fiscal authorities and the monetary authorities to the banks. The banks to create sustainable, lasting inflation and global growth, you need the banks to lend, and they just simply are not doing it. I can show you chart after chart that they're not making loans. There was a huge spike a year ago in Q2. When they did the PPP loans and the government guaranteed the loans. Of course, the banks will go out and make loans when the government guarantees them. But when they have to actually put their own capital on the line and risk their own money, it's been, you know, every quarter since last Q2 last year, it's just down, 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 down. And bank lending is not happening. And the reason this is important is, and this we'll get into another area of debate, but when you have securitized debt, in other words, when people borrow through bonds or when governments borrow through bonds and issue debt and issue debt-based securities, you're just recycling money that already exists. Somebody is buying that bond with money they already have.
Right.
But when banks lend, they're actually creating new money, right? And so that's new money getting into the system. And you need new money to get into the system to get lasting inflation. Now, in the meantime, you know, if government spends or if they defer... If they say you don't have to make a payment, they deferred a bunch of mortgages, they deferred rent. You got preferential terms on the inventory that you owed or the trade invoice that you owed. They can help out with the deflationary pressures by deferring that stuff, but they can't actually solve it, right? But in the meantime, we have had a number, due to COVID, we've had a number of supply chain disruptions. And that has led to prices rising in a number of commodities. And if you get a situation where supply chains are choked because trade's not happening or ships aren't moving or supply chains are broken, and you get that coinciding with a government stimulus plan at the same time that they don't have to pay their mortgages, right? You're going to get some temporary inflationary pressures. So I have not been surprised at what's happening. I just don't think it can continue unless they hand that off to the banks and the banks then start creating new money. So let's bring this back to the commodities that you talked about and specifically the agricultural ones. I think that, again, without the banks lending, demand will fall. I don't think that we will have this sustainable global reflation and global growth. So I think industrial commodities could suffer under that scenario. But you're always going to need food, right? Mm. It doesn't matter whether you're in a recession or a depression or a boom or high growth, you're always going to need food. People right. have to eat. And so those same supply chain issues have hit crops, but then also crop production in some places has been constrained a little bit due to weather or due to other factors, disease. But people need to eat. And so I'm not sure that we're going to, even if we get a big pullback in commodity prices, industrial commodities, I'm not sure we'll get a pullback or the same level of pullback in agricultural commodities.
Okay, so just keeping it in simple terms, we've got two sides of the equation when we're talking about consumer price inflation. Yep. You've got the demand side and the supply side. So right now you're saying the supply side is taking a hit. That's why you're seeing prices go up. Demand has stayed the same due to government intervention. We'll call them stimmy checks, PPP, whatever. But in the future, you see maybe more gridlock in governments. That's not going to be a reality forever. Therefore, demand comes down and supply will come down maybe less than the rate of demand, except for in commodities, where the demand will stay consistent due to the fact that we all have to eat, but the supply chain disruption will continue because of things that take a long time to turn back around from these supply chains being disrupted in the first place. And therefore, ag prices, food prices could go up. There's a high probability that they continue to go up for the next 2-3 years.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. And it doesn't mean that it'll go in a straight line, but, I generally get labeled a deflationist a lot, and I don't necessarily mind it, but I don't really consider myself a deflationist per se. Mm-hmm. I don't mind getting that label, but I just think that I'm open to inflation happening, but certain things continuing to happen. I'll say that to continue to go. But I just have to see certain things happen for me to make that, to take inflation. And I know everybody laughs at when the Fed says inflation is transitory. I know that gets a good chuckle. But unless I see some certain things happen, I tend to agree with them on this. And I don't agree with central banks very often. And I certainly don't like them. And I hate having to agree with them on certain occasions. But, if we get inflation due to, again, to supply chain constraints, I totally get it. But if people think that we're going to have inflation, because we're going to have this runaway global growth, I think it's just complete BS, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. You know, what's funny, Brent, I don't know if I told you, but I had lunch with Snyder the other day in West
Palm. Oh, did you really? Oh,
I love that. Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And, I won't go off on a tangent, but I learned more in that hour and a half conversation, just meeting with him face to face, than probably all the macro interviews I've listened to or times that I've interviewed him. It was just something really, really cool. But anyway, he had the same thing to say. He's like, you know what? I don't think I've ever agreed with Jerome Powell in my life, but this time, what he's saying, it's transitory. I actually do agree with him. He said the exact same thing you did.
That's so funny. I hate it. I actually hate it.
Yeah, that's what he said. So it takes me back to the conversation that you had with Russell Napier on Real Vision when you interviewed him. I know he's one of both of our favorites. Yeah. And I first heard him talk about this with Eric on Macro Voices, and how he kind of went from the deflation camp or to the inflation camp because he felt as though in the future, the government would come in and backstop the majority of the bank lending, therefore incentivize the banks to lend a lot more, because if they can just flip that paper to the Fed, then why not? You know, there's no downside for them. And I know you had the chance to talk to him about that just over Zoom. So what do you think about that? About that hypothesis moving forward?
Well, I think it's a fantastic hypothesis. And, I take Russell more seriously than I do many other people, especially with this particular topic, because his writings is actually what helped me continue to dig long ago when I was thinking that we should be having inflation kind of 13-14 timeframe, and we weren't. And, his writings kind of helped me to kind of rethink things a little bit. And so he helped me to kind of understand the deflationary pressures that were present in the market and helped me kind of formulate my dollar thesis, for lack of a better. His writings definitely had an input into my thinkings regarding my dollar thesis. And so for him to flip, been a year ago now, he's flipped from, hardcore deflationist to inflationist. And I think his observations are fantastic. And this kind of goes to what I was saying, like, if the banks start lending again, especially now we've got all these reserves, right? The reserve, they can lend, they have the capacity to do major lending.
Right.
But they're not, right? And so, but if they start lending again, then we can start getting some further inflationary pressures and sustainable inflationary pressures. But I just don't see them doing it. I see them going out and buying bonds. They're buying bonds and flipping them to the Fed. You know, there's, you know, I had a very interesting call the other day. I have a client and their his family is an extremely large landowner, real estate developer, one of Wells Fargo's biggest clients. And he told me, I mean, they've been doing business with Wells Fargo for 50 years. And they out of all the value of the real estate that they own versus the amount of debt that they owe to Wells Fargo is 8%. So they've only got an 8% debt ratio against their assets. And to borrow more money, he said Wells Fargo wants to charge them higher rates and doesn't want to give them more loans. Now think about that. You've got a family that's been successfully developing real estate and doing projects for 50 years. It's one of your biggest clients. They've got a very low loan to asset ratio and you don't want to give them a loan. But the thesis, but the narrative is that there's all this liquidity out there. There's so much money sloshing around. So I just think there's a difference between the narrative and reality. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible to get a loan. I'm not saying that money isn't moving, but I don't think it's, I don't think that the narrative, the popular narrative actually meets reality right now. And I think when the narrative is exposed, I think that we're going to have volatility. And so I'm not telling people to sell everything and go sit in cash because, you know, we're going to have a crisis tomorrow. But I just think this, you know, again, to steal a central banker's words, irrational exuberance that we're seeing across all markets right now, I personally think is unwarranted.
Yeah. So it seems like to get a home mortgage, let's say, that's pretty easy to do. To get a car loan, that's pretty easy to do. But if you think about it, it's because they're just flipping the paper right to Fannie or Freddie or to a hedge fund or something. So those that paper is being securitized and then taking, then Wall Street's taking over from there. It's not staying on the balance sheet of the bank itself. So if a loan is actually going to stay on the balance sheet of the bank, then maybe they're a lot more hesitant to make that loan. And your point is that because the commercial banking system creates the majority of dollars in the system by issuing new loans, the amount of the lending will go down, the commercial bank lending will go down, therefore fewer dollars created faster than the government spending money on stimulus and the Fed monetizing it. Can get it out into the system. So if the Fed spends the government spends $5 trillion into the economy, the Fed monetizes it, that increases M2 money supply by, let's say, 25%. And if you see the next year or two, the bank lending decreasing by more than the $5 trillion that the government spent in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and you just, I know this is, we keep talking about other people here, but, you know, Jeff is, and for people that don't know, we're talking Jeff Snyder, right? Mm-hmm. And Jeff Snyder is just fantastic. I encourage everybody to read his stuff. You know, he hates the velocity of money statistic because it's just a remainder from, you know, some calculations. But at the end of the day, if money is not moving, right? If money is not moving, you're going to have a credit contraction. And if new loans aren't being created, money is not going to be moving at the rate that it could be.
Right.
And, you can have inflation or you can have velocity from two different sources. You can have new money coming in, or you can have the existing money circulating, and the existing money is not circulating, right? The Fed's doing everything and the governments are doing everything they can to convince everybody to go spend money, and they're doing everything to try to get the banks to lend, but the banks aren't lending. People are spending. So they've convinced that part of the world or that part of the game to do what they're supposed to do. But now they're trying to get the banks to lend, and the banks just aren't doing it. And I think until the banks do that, you know, I'm not on board with this sustainable recovery.
Yeah, I think what's so hard for people to get their head around is it goes back to what Hazlitt talked about in the seen and the unseen. And what we can see is the government sending all the stimulus checks out. We can see the average income of Americans going up by 20% in March, as an example. Yeah. But what we can't see is all the bank lending that isn't happening right now. And I think that's what's so hard. So, you know, I think.
I think that's the one of, before I forget, let me just make a point real quick.
You got to
make sure, don't confuse with new money coming into existence with more money coming into existence. The analogy I like to use is a bucket with holes in it. Mm. And you've got a bucket full of water with holes in it, and water's draining out. And you can pour more money in from the top to keep the bucket, you know, from going dry. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the water level in the bucket's rising. The governments and the monetary, they've started pouring money in from the top, and they've instituted programs to plug a few of the holes, at least temporarily. So maybe in the short term, the water level's rising, but we haven't gotten into a situation where it's just overflowing over the top and money's just gushing everywhere. And I think that's it seems to me everybody has just accepted that that is what's going to happen. So you better get in front of it. And maybe it will. And if it does, you know, I'll be fine. My clients will be fine. But I'm not betting on that happening. I'm not accepting that as fact as most everybody else is.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
You know, what I've tried to think through, or what's helped my thinking on this, is I look at it as three different options or three different scenarios. Scenario one is the system would stay the exact same as it has been. The commercial banks responsible for the majority of quote unquote money creation, but there are no more quantitative easing, no more stimulus, no more government or Fed intervention. In that scenario, the system would want to deflate. You would have massive deflation, especially asset deflation. That is for sure.
Right.
Scenario number two is where the system stays the same, but you have increased stimulus up to a certain point. And let's just say and I asked Snyder this question actually one time before. I said, well, what if the government just sent everyone a check for $1 million? He said, okay, well, yeah, that would create consumer price inflation, but it would stop. It would just increase prices to a level they'd plateau. Yeah. Right. And then you'd keep going.
It wouldn't be a 45 degree angle that just continues up to the right. It'd be a stair step, and then you'd plateau, and then you wouldn't go anywhere again.
I think in that scenario, you would have this drastic increase of inflation, but then you might slip back into disinflation. So it goes up to 10%, but then the next year, let's say it goes down to 8, goes down to 6, goes down to 2, to where we kind of get back to where we are. Then scenario go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you kind of think about it, that's kind of what happened after 2008. We had the big downturn, global bailouts, assets went back up, but then, you know, things kind of went sideways for a long time, especially like in Europe. You know, the U.S. recovered better than Europe did in other parts of the world, but, you know, people forget. I mean, this is one of my pet peeves, as you know, is that people just focus on the Fed and just focus on the United States. I mean, Japan's been doing QE for 20 years. You know, Europe's been doing it for 10. They've never escaped the previous crises. So to think that now all of a sudden the central bankers have figured it out and everything's under control, I just think it's silly. Sorry, right. I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought there.
No problem. I'd like to get your opinion on this scenario number three.
Yeah.
And that's where the whole system changes. And I know, see, your job, so you're a professional. So you have to stay within the realm of kind of, you know, what's kosher and the sure. what's realistic probabilities. Or I'm an amateur, so I can get really crazy and just let my imagination run wild. So let's say the system completely changes. And what I was thinking through is if the Fed has a central bank digital currency, so all the entities and the individuals have an account with the Fed, and that the Fed can start lending directly to consumers, they can start lending directly to entities and create that money supply that the banks have been responsible for creating so long. But the difference is they don't have a P&L, really. Can they have negative equity? They don't really have to put that priority on being paid back. They can just issue as much loans or as many loans as they possibly can to whoever can fog a mirror, something like you saw in Japan in the 1980s, as an example. Yeah. And what's interesting about that is it doesn't affect the federal government's balance sheet either. It's just the balance sheet between the consumers or the entities in the real economy and the Fed. So if we got into that situation, and I know the probabilities might be low, but who knows? I would have said that about people being locked in their houses in 2018 as well. But what do you think about that?
Well, I think what you are describing is actually going to happen. Hmm. I do think that that's where we're headed. Now, I would say that the reason I'm always kind of reticent to say something like that is because then people will go out and say, Brent Johnson said that, you know, the banks are going to go away. Everybody's going to have an account with the Fed and, you know, they're going to give us money that expires and we're going to have huge inflation. So go buy gold and go buy all these inflationary assets because it's, you know, it might not happen for 3 years. So I'm not, do you see what I'm saying? Like imminent and inevitable are not the same thing. And I try to say that over and over and over. And imminent and inevitable are not the same thing.
Yeah, I think we see eye to eye there because I always talk about this happening potentially 5 years, 10 years down the road, because at some point, you know what else is interesting too? I went back and looked at the history of the central bank of the United States. You know, the first central bank was set up by Hamilton.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but the reason he set up the bank was not only to fund the government, but also to fund entities in the real economy. To lend directly to businesses because the banks in England weren't doing it for a variety of reasons. That was the initial reason the central bank was set up. So, I mean, maybe they're going back to, and then going back to that conversation I had with Snyder, he was talking about how in the 1960s, with the help of Friedman and other economists, they realized that the free market, the Eurodollar system, had really kind of solved the problems of Triffin's dilemma temporarily.
They
didn't know how long it would last, but they're like, okay, let's just use this benign neglect.
Yeah.
And then we'll just let it
That's
be.
That's the perfect way to say it.
It doesn't exist.
Benign and then, neglect, yeah.
But they know in the back of their minds that the central banks are not central to the dollar. They're not in control of the dollar that the commercial banks are. So wouldn't this be a neat way to take back control of the dollar while at the same time lending directly into the real economy like the original intention of Hamilton was? I'm not saying that's good. But then at the same time, you get to make all the politicians happy because you can direct that lending to groups that have gained favor with XYZ politician.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. I actually brought this up with Russell as well, because again, this is something I think is going to happen. I think that we are, if you look at the number of banks in existence, look at the trend of the number of banks in the United States in existence over the last 20 years. And it just goes lower and lower and lower and lower. Mm. And the big banks, and it's partly due to just mergers and acquisitions, but it's partly due to the number of regulations that have been put on banking systems. And, you know, the small community banks can't afford the legal costs of complying with all these regulations. And so you get, you know, more and more big banks and fewer small community banks. And you end up with one bank eventually, right? But as those, here's where I think it gets interesting, is as those big banks get bigger and bigger, at the same time, and when you get bigger, you typically get more powerful, right? And banks have had huge influence in both business and politics for years. But as we move towards this thesis that you're talking about, where everybody has an account directly with the Fed, that's talking about bypassing these big, powerful institutions, right? And it, to a certain extent, starts to compete with them and makes them mm-hmm. unnecessary. So I have a hard time believing that these big, you know, politically powerful and, you know, economically powerful institutions are just going to say, okay, we'll retire. We'll go, you know, I think there's going to be a battle between, you know, central banks, you know, treasury departments, you know, the Fed, you know, central banks. I don't think it's just going to be this smooth transition, and I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. But it'll, you know, everybody's talked about, you know, Janet Yellen was the former Fed secretary. Now she's Treasury. So Treasury and Fed are just going to work like one hand in the glove. And maybe that'll happen, but I won't be surprised if there's some friction along the way, because I don't think Jerome Powell and the other central banks are just going to cede power to the Treasury departments. And I think that'll happen around the world too. Again, we're kind of talking about the US and the Fed here, but this is not just it's going to happen in the ECB. It's going to happen in Japan. It's going to happen in China. It's going to happen in Australia and Canada and Greece. And well, not Greece because they use ECB, but you know, again, this is, it's fine to talk about it with relation to the United States, but it's not just the United States. And the other thing that I think is interesting about this is, again, a pet peeve of mine, if you give me a minute to rant on this, is that I often hear that, you know, China is light years ahead of us with regard to digital currencies, and they're going to roll out this digital yuan, and it's just going to eat the dollar's lunch, and they're going to back it with gold, and, you know, they're going to take over the world. In other words, it's like this positive thing for China. But then when they talk about the United States rolling out a digital coin, it's these nefarious central bankers are trying to, you know, take control of everything, and it's going to lead to the collapse of the dollar, and the dollar is going to go to zero. Now, why does the digital dollar or digital yuan allow China to take over and the yuan to become a reserve currency? But for the dollar, it makes it lose its value and loses its status. I mean, it's just the hypocrisy of those two arguments. Just, it kind of drives me crazy a little bit. I don't think either one of them is necessarily good. But the idea that it's great for one and bad for the other, I think it's wrong. I wanted to make that point.
One thing that I've thought about periodically is how the reserve status of the dollar can be maintained a lot longer by the borrowing costs of borrowing in dollars being a lot lower. So if you're a corporation XYZ in Colombia, you can borrow pesos at 12%. You can borrow dollars at 5%. Right. You're going to borrow dollars all day long, and or replace that with yuan, digital yuan. You're going to borrow yuan at 7% or dollars at 3%. You're still going to borrow dollars at 3%, which, correct me if I'm wrong, creates future demand for dollars.
It just reinforces.
So we have to see the dollar lending globally start to shrink. But how does that happen unless interest rates for borrowing dollars are a lot higher?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're kind of making one of my arguments for me, is that, you know, this is why once they're entrenched, global reserve currencies are so hard to unseat, right? They have that network effect, right? I mean, and it's a network effect writ large. I mean, it's not just an emerging network effect. I mean, it is an institutionalized worldwide network. And I'm not saying that it can never change. And in fact, it will change at some point, but the idea that it's just going to change overnight peacefully, and the dollars in the US is going to suffer, and the rest of the world's going to, you know, be free of the shackles and, you know, be have this great economic future. I just think that that's completely naive. I just don't think it works that way. So anyway,
How much of the pressure of these entities, countries, corporations that have dollar-denominated debt, and they got into such trouble when the DXY was over 100, yeah, let's say, how much pressure is relieved with a DXY at 90?
Or a lot.
A lot. Okay.
A lot. And that's, I think that's why you've seen this global reflation over the last 12 months. But the irony is that, you know, 13 months ago, the dollar was crushing everybody. And they were like, we got to get out from underneath this, you know, to the weight of this dollar. Hmm. And since then, the dollar's pulled back 10%. And rather than pay off that dollar debt and use this, you know, relative weakness to their advantage, they took out more loans. Yeah. They issued more U.S. dollar debt. So it not only have they not taken steps to get away from the dollar, they've actually reinforced the dollar. And when the dollar rises again, which it will, the same thing is going to happen again.
Yeah. So let's walk through the steps of the dollar rising right now, because currently we're just in this mode. When I, you know, one of the things that makes this so difficult too, is we've gone from having to answer economic questions in 2019 to now we're having to answer political questions.
Yeah.
Right. Because you can't answer the first one without knowing the answer to the second one because of what we described with those three different scenarios, which I think we agree on. So right now we've got just the government in stimulus hyperdrive. You know, every single time you hear Biden speaks, he wants another 2, 4, 10 trillion, 20 trillion in stimulus for this. So with that going on in the background, how do we get the DXY up to 100 or 110? Or do you need to see kind of a pause with what's going on politically and the Fed monetizing the debt and the spending before you say, okay, we're off to the races with the dollar again?
Well, here's what I think is interesting. I'm going to answer your question. I'm not ignoring it, but I want to kind of build up to it. Is that, because I think it's important to think, and I think people lose sight of this, is that a year ago, you know, the Fed came out and the Treasury, you know, they came out and said, we're going to do all these things. And the dollar fell. You know, as they said, as they were saying, we're going to do all these things, the dollar just fell. But the dollar right now is only slightly below where it was in September. So by September, they had only done a few of these many things that said they were going to do. But since September, we've had a Democrat get elected to the White House. We've had the Democrats take over Congress. We've had the blue wave. We've had a stimulus plan, three stimulus plans or two, I lose track, two or three stimulus plans, an infrastructure bill, and, you know, promises for more, you know, the Fed saying over and over again, you know, inflation's transitory, we're not taking our foot off the gas, we're not even thinking about raising rates, and the dollar hasn't fallen since all of that stuff has happened, right? So think of if a year ago I told you that we're going to have three stimulus plans, an infrastructure bill, Democratic president, a blue wave, you think the dollar's going to fall, but it hasn't. Right. It fell ahead of that. It fell on the anticipation of that stuff happening, but it hasn't fallen since that actually happened. And so I said, and I'm not going to sit here and say the dollar can't go lower. It certainly can go lower. You know, anybody who thinks that they know for sure what's going to happen and they tell you, you should just run the other way. And even if I don't care if it's me telling you this is certainly going to happen, don't listen to me either, because I don't know what's going to happen. What I do know is that, you know, we are not the only ones in this situation, right? And I am under no illusions that we're going to all of a sudden get religion and start being fiscally conservative. These stimulus plans are going to continue to come. We're going to continue to spend money. We're going to get another infrastructure bill, and it'll be bigger than the first one. We'll probably get more, you know, stim checks. You know, but I don't necessarily think it will just be, you know, easy. I think there will be, you know, some political pushback along the way. But the other thing is that it's not just going to happen here. It's going to happen in Europe. It's going to happen in Japan. It's going to happen in China and Australia and Canada. I mean, I'll share this with you. I don't think many people realize this. Like, if I were to tell you Everybody, you know, the big thing when you start talking about losing the currencies, losing values, you know, monetizing the debt, right? Well, you know, in Europe last year, they monetized 85% of central bank issuance last year. They monetized like 150% of Greek issuance, I think 125% of Spanish issuance. They monetized a lot more of European sovereign issuance than the United States monetized of U.S. And the same in Japan. The other thing is that if I asked you which country had, if you look at the central bank balance sheets and the sovereign bonds that the central bank owns of the country that they represent, who do you think leads the way? Out of all the major countries, who do you think owns the biggest portion of the balance sheet or the sovereign issuance?
You, as far as the central banks, what's their balance sheet as far as what they own?
If you look at all the sovereign issuance that a country has made and then the percent that is now sitting on that central bank balance sheet. So the central bank's gone out and bought X percent of total sovereign issuance. Mm. Well, I'll just say, I mean, Japan leads the way at 44%.
So the central bank owns 44% of the outstanding JGBs. Yeah. I thought it was 60.
Well, that may include some mortgage debt and stuff in Japan. I'm not sure. The number I have is the treasury bonds. Basically, I'm the percent of treasury bonds held by a central bank. That's the numbers, right? I'm working with. And it starts with Japan at 44%. The Eurozone owns 42%. Canada's 42%. Australia's 39%. The United Kingdom is 36%. Guess what the United States is?
Oh, I'd say, what, 20%? Something
like that? About 23%. So okay. It's about half of what Japan and Europe is.
Hmm.
But yet everybody thinks that the dollar's, you know, that the Fed's out of control and the dollar's going to lose value. Now, why is it so much worse for the debt, the Fed and the dollar than it is for the euro? I mean, I know I keep coming back to this, but I think it's vitally important for people to understand this, that currencies trade relative to each other. Now, that doesn't mean that the dollar can't go lower. It doesn't mean that, you know, we can't stay in this, you know, inflationary environment for a little bit longer. But, you know, we are not acting in a vacuum. And, you know, the same way that our sins are going to catch up to us, they're going to catch up with the other countries as well.
So could we have a situation where the dollar goes to 110, let's say, on the DXY, because it's really just measured against a basket of other currencies, mostly euros. Right. I think it's 57% euros.
Yeah.
Could that happen while at the same time consumer prices in the United States continue to go up?
Absolutely.
So the dollar goes down against goods and services, but up against other fiat currencies.
Absolutely. That's the milkshake theory. That's the thesis, right? I don't know that we're going to have this massive deflationary event where everybody's wiped out. I can't rule it out. I'm prepared for it. But ultimately, what I think happens is when the sovereign debts of the world become unserviceable, and I don't know where it's going to, I don't know if it's going to kick off in Canada first or Italy first or Greece first or Hong Kong first or Canada or China first, but I think it will kick off and I think it will become, there will lead to contagion. And I think when that happens, you're going to see the dollar rise versus other currencies. Now, perhaps the dollar will lose value versus commodities and gold and other asset prices. So I still think that we can get into an environment where the Dow, the dollar, gold, and some other, you know, risk assets rise versus everything else. I mean, that's essentially the milkshake theory. Is that the dollar, the Dow, gold, and other risk assets rise while the rest of the world deflates?
Yeah.
So their markets deflate while their currency loses value. Yeah.
So I want to kind of add to the point you're making that all these things have happened, but yet the dollar is still hovering around, let's call it 91, 92 on the DXY. But also, I think we're running the largest trade deficits we've ever run. Yeah. So, you know, you throw that into the mix. But do you think if we continue to run these huge trade deficits that just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger because we're paying people to stay home and not produce goods and services, that could alleviate some of the dollar problems outside of the United States? because there's more dollars getting out to the international system.
It could for a while, and I think that's what they're trying to do, right? I think they're trying to keep the game going. You know, like it's central bankers and monetary authorities are masters at extending the game. But, you know, eventually you hit reality, right? Eventually you look at exponential curves, eventually exponential curves turn over and just crash. Right. Eventually the debts will get so big is that they will just implode on themselves. And again, I don't know if it takes 6 weeks, 6 months, or another 6 years. I don't think it'll take another 6 years, but you know, nothing's impossible. But what I'm absolutely convinced that is not going to happen. And again, nothing is certain, but you know, a lot of people think that we're going to have this global reset as the dollar loses value. I just don't think that that's the case. I think the dollar losing value extends the game. The dollar losing value reinforces the system as it currently exists,
right?
It's the dollar getting away from the monetary, you know, authorities and central bankers and rising and causing chaos, which causes the system to reset.
Maybe that's the end game. You know, maybe the end game is the dollar getting so strong, creating asset price deflation while we've got consumer price inflation. But because the whole economy is so addicted to asset prices, it's just really built on asset prices. Yep. The Fed and the government can't have that because the economy is collapsing due to asset prices. Although, again, I just want to reiterate, consumer prices going up, but the dollar going up on the DXY, that they come in and say, we have to take control of the dollar. And the only way to do it is through a central bank digital currency.
Very possible. I mean, essentially, that's what I think. I think the system will reset as a result of the dollar getting stronger, not weaker.
All right, buddy. I know you've got a hard deadline coming up here soon. So I want to give a quick plug. We're almost sold out for Rebel Capitalist Live, but you're going to be there speaking face to face. It's not one of these things over Zoom or Skype. It's an actual real conference. Yeah. So Brent Johnson is going to be there speaking. I can't wait. I want to thank you personally. I want to thank you personally for agreeing to come down to Miami and meet everyone and give a presentation. And you're just going to take our chat today and just extend it even further with graphs and charts. And it's going to be amazing. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, Brent, where can they go?
A couple different places. You can always send me an email. My email is brent@santiagocapital.com. I'm very active on Twitter, as you know. Santiago AU Fund is my Twitter handle. You can also just type in Santiago Capital in the search box, and I think you'll find me. Santiagocapital.com has all my contact information. You know, I always encourage people to email me and DM me and, you know, feel free to reach out. I will say it's gotten to be a real chore to respond to everybody. I apologize. I apologize. If you've sent me a message and I haven't gotten back to you, I apologize tremendously. It's not that I'm trying to ignore you. Feel free to email me again or reach out again. I try to get back to everybody, but I'm not always successful.
Now, did you put laser eyes on your Twitter profile yet?
No, I didn't. you know, I still own a little Bitcoin, but I can't do the laser eyes.
Yeah, neither could I. All right, man. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, man.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to join me in Miami this June 11th through the 13th for Rebel Capitalist Live, the investment conference. And this is not over Zoom. This is face to face. I'm bringing a lot of your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist Show to Miami under one roof to speak, to give you the knowledge you need to increase your personal freedom, to become a better investor and make larger returns over the next few years when we have this financial uncertainty that's being caused by the Fed and the government. And finally, it's going to give you an opportunity to really take your understanding of macroeconomics and the world around us to the next level. We've got some incredible speakers lined up that are going to completely blow you away. People like Mike Maloney, Jason Hartman, Ken McElroy, Lynette Zhang, Mark Moss, Brent Johnson, Jeff Snyder, just to name a few. The tickets for this event are really going to sell out fast, so make sure you go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now to get all the details and to reserve your spot. We need to come together as a group, as a community, especially after what we dealt with in 2020 and 2021, so we can learn how to build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. And we need to do this as a group, as a community of fellow rebel capitalists. So don't waste any time. Head over to rebelcapitalistlive.com and I will see you in Miami.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.